David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 336. I'm your host, Steve Raker, coming at you from where the sun don't shine, down in the comic book bunker. Just a quick intro this week before I bring on Andrew and Kevin to talk about our recent reads. Marvel Noise is a podcast proudly sponsored by nobody, but happy to be part of the Deliberate Noise network of podcasts. We have a Facebook page, a Twitter handle, at Marvel Noise, and our website, marvelnoise.com, is perfect for streaming and downloading episodes, both old and new. There's a handy little drop-down menu on the right-hand side that lets you get to any month, any episode, without having to scroll through blog page after blog page. Man, I've been so busy with both my kids playing tackle football this fall, I'm having trouble finding time to podcast, heck, even read. Can't wait for things to slow down a little bit by Halloween when one of their seasons ends. Speaking of Halloween, next episode will be our Halloween episode with the next annual installment of our Tomb of Dracula revisitation. Jerry McDade will be back on task this year to hit issues 45 to 50 with me. We'll also have our Baltimore Comic-Con wrap-up, which is where I'll be with my pal Mike Spring from the After the Ending podcast while you're distracted by this very episode. I can't wait to walk the con floor, talk to friends and heroes in the industry, and look at and hopefully score some great comic book art. The Baltimore Comic Con. It's the best show on earth. See you in Baltimore. All right, it's been too long. What's going on, guys? We've got WWX Kevin here from the Above the Border, and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit from way out, a little bit north of, well, his closest border. What's going on, guys?
We're sort of on the border, we could say. How about that? On the border.
Until you slide into the Pacific, at least. Wow.
I don't know how to do this anymore. Andrew, say something about indie comics.
Kevin, you know, say hi, Kevin.
Hello.
There we go. Now we're back into it. You gotta lead that horse to water, Steve.
Dude, before we go get into talking about the books we've been reading, I just gotta give you guys a pat on the back and a little respect for the amount of indie comic book noises that have been firing out over the podcasting interwebs. Can't keep up with you guys, but I have finally read some indie books, so I got to get on another episode so I can spill my guts.
Yes, please. It's not the same without you, Steve. Kevin and I flounder around hopelessly.
Gets me to read some comics.
That's been my problem. I haven't been reading enough comics, and just in the last about week or so, I have made it more of a priority in those in-between times rather than gathering myself for whatever the next challenge is. I was like, you know what? I'm going to stop and jump into some comics. It's a good thing to be able to do.
ABC, boys. Always be comic booking.
When I was a youth, Fanico, which was my LCS in the early 80s, late 70s, it was on the other side of, it was like downtown from where I lived, kind of on in like the first area that was not really a suburb, but it just wasn't the city proper. And the park, Washington Park in Albany, the capital district that I grew up in upstate New York here, the park was in between the comic store and me. So my friends and I, we would go and have our misadventures on the way there. And on the way back, just find a nice set of trees to sit under or to sit up in and read some comics. Always good to just be able to stop the world and jump into some comics, even while you're just soaking in the sunshine or whatever else around you. Comics is good.
I don't know if it was a trend for Central and Northern New York, but my first comic book shop also had a non-comic book shop name. It was Fantasy Exchange. And my buddies worked there, and it'd be funny because some people would stop there and think it was a different sort of shop.
So where's the real merchandise?
And they'd have very disappointed looks when they'd just see racks of comic books there. But yeah, Fantasy Exchange, shout out to Fantasy Exchange. Wherever you are, you're long since out of business.
Hey kids, comics. How about those Hickman X books? I know there's been a few other podcasts that have really gone into depth on the events and the twists and turns that Hickman's been supplying to his treatment of the X-Men books here. But rather than get into minutiae, I just want to say overall that it really has that weighty Hickman feel to it. As far as you can tell that he's done his homework and the world building and probably has some, crazy flow chart on his wall somewhere,
For me, it's been really nice after the, like I said, I'm skipping the Carnage thing, but I did the deep dive on the last event before this, and it's really nice to just have it be the two series. While the scope is enormous, it's very focused, and it's leading you, and it's clear, and there's no big questions about what's this doing, and is this really connected or anything. And it's really, that's the part I'm also, like I said, well executed, as you said, great artwork. I'm laughing and having a good time with it, really. But it's just nice that they can drill this thing down and say, you know what, we're not going to have 75 tie-in series, we're just gonna tell this story,
give it time. I'll tell you though, you make a good point though. For the amount, I've really grown weary of time travel stories and alternate universe versions of the characters' stories, especially in X books. I mean, I felt like that was almost a X-Men cliche thing for a while there after everyone wanted to do their Days of Future Past kind of thing. And then with the Age of Apocalypse and all that stuff, it seemed like the thing to do, here's some X-Men from the future coming back, or some alternate X-Men. And, it spilled over into the rest of the Marvel Universe too. And maybe comicdom in general, where it feels like I'm getting beaten down in trying to parse out, the Jack, Steve, and Stan universe that I think of as my coherent true comic reality, basically, at least as I perceive it, the real false history, if you will. But for the amount of time travel that's going on in here and some of the other characters from the different time eras that he's presenting, he does manage to keep it fairly clear and keeping the cast down pretty good for an X-Men book, even though he's touching upon a lot of different X-Men. Sometimes it's just for a panel or two to say like what their role is or how they kind of fit into his machine, and then it's off to but that's not the story we're telling right now. That's just an aspect of it to to embellish it. It has worked good, although, and this is where Kevin and I might really disagree, I'm guessing, I'm not a big fan of the info dumps that happened text-wise. I mean, sometimes they've been enlightening and timely. Okay, that's a good time to tell me about that. But it really takes me out of the story to all of a sudden hit one of those text pieces.
You
don't like the sinister gossip message board, Steve? Is that what you're saying?
That had a couple of funny lines on it.
I'm normally with you, Steve, but I think the execution here is almost Watchmen-esque of providing sub. I mean, you're right in the sense that sometimes I feel like he puts too much essential information in the text piece, where Watchmen, I think the balance was better about having it be complimentary but not needed. You could just read the story without that and not miss anything. But I'm really, normally I'm weary of it, but somehow Hickman knows how to put those charts and vary them up and not have too much. It's not as much of a drag as I oftentimes find those things where I just, it stops the story thudding. The one I didn't like was, I didn't like that they provided the substitution code for the Krakoa language, because then it clearly undermined that it's not really a language. It's just like, here's your Dakota ring.
Yeah.
And it's a letter substitution. That part, I mean, it's a pretty minor, trivial thing, but for a guy that thinks in such epic scope to sort of kneecap his quote-unquote language seemed unneeded. Like, what are we going to get? Like, I decoded some stuff, and then I was like, you know what, this really, it takes it away from having its own syntax and spellings and things like that in a significant way. It shouldn't be just this symbol means this letter type of thing.
Yeah, I'm not going back and you know, decoding any of those earlier messages. It's like, no. I prefer it to be more like a dupe thing where you don't have a clue.
Well, yes. You can read dupe.
Well, yeah. But you don't
I
have
can't.
To. You don't have to.
Kevin, you can read dupe. I would need to have it translated and look at the guide. I didn't memorize the code. But no, I'm with the other thing, not to harp on my point too much, but because it's one thing, there's no element that's been pulled out and put in another book, which is nice. You know, you don't have to worry about, am I getting all the right tie-ins or whatever? You're like, everything you need is in these what's, you know, soon to be finished book, and the pacing is kind of good. I will say I did cheat and I was reading them weekly, and then I slacked and read a bunch together.
Crazy.
Ditto. I read them as a big chunk, and I really liked it that way, because it's a page turner. Certainly. One other thing about those, what you said about the text pieces and the infographics and stuff, is the amount of information that does get dumped into those spaces. If they gave us, you know, Claremont pages of them rattling off that information and talking to each other about it, I would just be flipping through those pages just to get to the next story beat, because that would be a lot to deal with that way too. So maybe since he has all the info and he wants to share it, the info, you know, maybe that is the best way to go, but doesn't mean I have to like it.
I like discussing them week to week.
Then we were saying about the last time about Moira McTaggart being such a catalyst because of her ability, her newly presented ability to have pre-existed in a number of different multiverses, and she's reliving reality over and over again, like what was that Bill Murray movie, Groundhog Day, you know? And she keeps trying to get it right and see how things are going to end up, and she's trying to help support the chess pieces on the board into the right places so that things turn out good in whatever life she is leading, because, hey, everyone wants to live a good life, right? But because of her, well, it was cool, too. They used her as a way to transfer information, because she understands, she remembers everything that she lived before at a certain point in her life. Then they, you know, they made it a point for her to learn something so that in her next chance at this crazy life, she would have that knowledge to be able to share with, you know, with her teammates. I thought that was, you know, an interesting dynamic to explore. But because of her and that, I don't even know that we're reading at all about the X-Men in Hour 616. Like, I wouldn't be surprised. Still? I wouldn't be surprised if the last issue they all die and it's like, you know, and they throw another curveball or something. I mean, there's things that aren't exactly right here, and it might just be retcons or whatever, but, you know, there's no, she could die at any time and this could be reset.
Well, I think they tried to, yeah, prevent that by saying the number of times,
yeah,
she's rebooting. Sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
No, you're saying what I was going to say. They they've set up things, and these things can be easily removed. Like, everything seemed weird, like, in issue 3. You're like, oh, why are they talking like this? Certain things aren't the way they're supposed to be, and then you get, like, that first page in the first issue, you get a reveal, and you're like, oh, that's probably why things went the way they were. So they don't want it to be unlimited, and they want to put, even though when things are seem like they can do anything, they also want to put some kind of trap door there, right?
Yeah. But also a Deus Ex Machina at any time. They can reset the board. I mean, and she's not the only one resurrecting, right? They basically came up with those resurrection pods that the mutants can just go on suicide missions and get killed. And I mean, in some ways, it's a, you know, what a funny nod to the fact that mutant deaths and resurrections have become trite. But I mean, they really put it right into the infrastructure of the X-Men's world there, where now they can be reborn at any time.
Gold balls!
Well, it does leave some of the mutants being certainly more important. And you could take out some of those without really upsetting the world. That was the nice thing, is that he built the mechanism so it required enough people that if they want to remove that, they just need to remove one of the people.
Right.
And then they can't, the factory is shut down, so to speak. So I like that. I mean, Hickman's smart enough to make everything so that it can be taken apart, because that's kind of the game. You know, Disney isn't letting these things go too far astray. It always has to be able to come back home. And speaking of which, I know it was probably for cynical reasons, because it keeps the title count down because they're only doing limited thing, but I really am glad this is a weekly thing too. By having all this coming out kind of on top of each other, even though, like I said, I cheated a little, it's been so much fun to have all this dense book, and then you can go right to the next one, or if you wait, you know, wait a week or whatever. I really am enjoying that more than I thought I would, because oftentimes they do the weekly thing, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I feel this one really works for me.
I also see that in October, when, you know, the same month that the last books of these series ends, the new books start too. So I think it's going to be a pretty, it's going to keep it coming. You're going to be able to get that appetite fed.
Oh, for sure, because they're not going to have just two X-Men like that. They're going to want to get it back to, you know, 10 books a month or whatever they feel they can support on the rack.
My favorite scene so far in this whole X-Men reboot here is Mr. Sinister adoring Magneto's cape and saying, like he's stating his desire for one, you know, like, why don't I have a cape? I need a cape. I would love to have a cape. That's a great cape, you know? I was just thinking, too bad it wasn't the Kirby half cape. Because that was really, like... But that's pretty funny, knowing that Sinister's going to have that crazy cape thing with the, you know, things sticking off it that are almost like feathers or whatever. It was funny to see him have cape envy.
Yeah, the only part I'm less into on a larger scale is I don't like the immutability of the human-mutant conflict. The fact that he drives home that's always inevitable.
Yeah.
And that seems a little cynical. Like, I don't, like, for a comic book, like, it's fine, I guess, but it just seems unnecessarily. I like a little bit of escapism in my books. I don't need it to always be the inevitable conflict and death and destruction of everything is how it always has to be. And I mean, I'm hoping for a happy ending.
It flies right in the face of the first story that all these X-Men time traveling things are all, you know, trying to recreate, that Days of Future Past thing, the preventing the crappy Sentinel future, you know?
Yeah. And it seems like that's always in all these futures. And this one isn't even about being happy. It's more just winning the war beforehand, which isn't really a great, Like, I don't really want them to win by exterminating all the humans or whatever. You know?
Those humans had it coming.
It just, it's not where my head is at. But I am massively enjoying. This has been a great event. I'm glad I bought into this thing. I can certainly understand people deciding to wait for Marvel Unlimited or trades or whatever. But for me and my money, it's been a fun ride. And Hickman's providing all those twists and turns. And I'm glad I went in with my Hickman expectation glasses on. And not, I think the people that are unhappy might not be familiar with what he does or how he does it. Because I feel like you said, this is right. This is his style and his mannerisms.
It was funny too to see at while this, you know, Hickman has returned to Marvel and doing this X-Men relaunch here, that I also got that real Hickman taste in my mouth when I was reading that History of the Marvel Universe limited series that's coming out. That's it's the Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez book, and they set that up with a sequence to open it up that is Franklin from the Hickman Fantastic Four book, bearded Franklin at the end of the universe when it's just him and Galactus at the end, the way he presented it. And they're old, and it's the last moments of the universe, and Franklin asks Galactus to remind him of what the life of the Marvel Universe was. So you get a Galactus narration of the history of the Marvel Universe. It's three issues in so far that I've read. And the first issue, at least, that deals more with like the early foundational forces that would then build into the Marvel Universe and kind of the origins of some of the locations and kind of the precursors to some of the locales that we're familiar with in the Marvel Universe, really felt to me, the first issue, like a collection of those backup stories, those Mark Gruenwald written and edited backup stories from the first volume of What If?, those tales of the Marvel Universe, when he would spend three or four pages and basically all you got out of the story was that's how the Deviants were created or something like that. Or that's how the blue area of the moon came to be. And I got a kick out of that, especially with Rodriguez's art. He does the colors as well as the line art. But as the series progresses, as I said, it's into the third issue. I'm guessing there's going to be five or six of them. It gets more into the Marvel chronology of, well, you know, now we're like getting into the late 80s, into the 90s, that kind of thing. And I'm less appreciative of the storytelling and just more enjoying seeing the big mashup pages, like the compositions that Rodriguez has to do, where he's fitting so many different types of events and references to things and trying to make it into like a two-page splash and that kind of stuff. I know you've been having trouble with this book, Andrew.
I have the first three issues. I think I might be out. I try a few times. It reads almost like a checklist to me.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing in it. It's just check, check, check. Like I'm just running down. I don't think it's like the Hickman thing at all. Like I feel like the Hickman stuff has a story and a flow, and it's not like this is badly done. I feel like the scope is just, it's too much. Like all we're gonna get is it, they don't have room to, I think why I've appreciated things like you know, the X-Men grand design, and I anticipate the Fantastic Four one, is that even though that stuff is so huge, even they can barely get room to breathe. But Abyss, yep. Like this thing would have to be 20 times the volume to have any kind of, I think, resonance with me in a way that doesn't feel dry. And by having it all checklisty, it also feels like they're really just trying to push everything together. And I don't know that I need a Marvel Universe that's that coherent, where there's some kind of order, like Eternity comes before at the same time as Chaos, but the Phoenix Force is from the last galaxy, but this, you know, I don't need to handbook these, all these kind of larger cosmic things together in a way where I'm ranking them like I'm in a video game.
It is, I think it's fun to see them attempt to have a big picture that is the Marvel history that we grew up with, but now they're updating it with the modern recons, you know, the retcons. Like, now you get to see Apocalypse, you know, thrown in there where he came into the story, so to speak, and like Hickman's Shield gets thrown in there with some of the old, again, some of those old Tales of the Marvel Universe kinds of things, and like the Man on the Wall and that kind of stuff. It's fun to see that's newer stuff thrown in with that old stuff, because I mean, it's only a checklist to us because we were there and we know this fictional history so well, and I kind of found it refreshing to have it organized in a way that it's like, oh yeah, that, and oh yeah, that, and oh yeah, that. And maybe I breezed through it too quickly to get into the Ohotmuy type analyzation of it that you're mentioning, but I just found it fun to be reminded of all of these things. But now that it's getting up into like where like it's the late 80s and 90s now, it's like, I don't need to have that. I don't need to be not that it was bad or anything, but I don't need to be reminded of that stuff.
Oh, now I have to read 4, 5, 6. That's where the good stuff is.
I really love the, and this is such a trivial thing, but that's me bringing up the really petty points. But what I love, I feel like the McNiven Farmer covers don't really match the Rodriguez,
no,
Lopez interiors in a way that I think it would have been better to go pick complementary art styles. I know that's really petty and stupid, but for some reason, when they're sitting on my pile and I see those covers and I'm expecting that sort of work, and then
it looks like Buscema Palmer, doesn't it? Those covers,
yeah, totally. And then you go inside and they're not going that, particularly because it's more, like you say, evocative of some of us of an age, you know what I mean? And then the interior art is great. Like you say, the compositions are fun and everything's well balanced and everything, but it's not tickling that nostalgia bone in the same way.
I liked being reminded of some of that crazy Kirby stuff, like the Eternals stuff and how it branched off to be the Titans on the moon and all that business. Like, I know that stuff, but I always find it interesting. Like, for some reason, it never occurred to me, not that it mattered, but like, oh yeah, Star Fox, Eros, Mentor's son, Thanos' brother, he has red hair just like his father, Mentor's brother, Zurus, the guy who is the head of the Eternals. He has red hair. Like, oh yeah. I don't even know if that was ever thought of when they had the character, but seeing those two in panel, you know, in one panel, they're talking about how Zurus and the guy who became Mentor separated, and Mentor went up to Titan and did his thing, and then in the very next panel, they're showing Thanos and Eros being born, and it's like, oh yeah, Star Fox has red hair, and I can look one panel to the left and see Zurus and go, oh yeah, they're family. Some of that stuff is, those connections are fun to revisit.
Well, part of the issue, and this is, again, I've talked about this ad nauseum, but my expectation level, because I had read recently another history book that took a different angle, and that was the Cosmic Ghost Rider Destroys the Marvel History book, which is the same kind of deep dive with a ton of insider jokes and gags and everything, but done through a narrative device.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I'm the first guy that's skeptical, as you know, of gimmicky celebrities doing comics. So I was a little wary. You know, it's Paul Scheer, the comedian, who I'm familiar with, and Nick Giovannetti, who I'm not familiar with. But I'm always wary, but I really enjoyed it. So I try not to let my blinders on. Oh, look, it's a guy that, you know, is a guitar player, wrestler, comedian, whatever. But still, if they can work the medium, they can work it. And they did an interesting kind of trade off on the art teams. I don't know if either of you guys read this series.
I did notice that each issue is a different artist, at least the first few. I didn't realize the thing about, I didn't realize that the author was somebody. But you know what's funny? Or maybe it's not so funny, but we are like mirror images of each other on this episode. I read the first issue and I, in the middle of the second one, I'm like, I got to flip through this. This is killing me. I really, it was tough sledding for me. I flipped through every, I looked at every panel and I flipped through every page, but I was not feeling this book at all.
I guess it was the humor that got to me. The conceit of it is we all know Frank Castle is the Cosmic Ghost Rider. So he's going to go back in time and stop his family from getting killed and stop the Punisher. So, you know, that's, so he goes to meet his family and poses as his uncle. And I just enjoyed, so it's all these deep references, because to impress his son, who he's portraying as his uncle, he tells him a bunch of stories that intersect with the Marvel history and all these things he did. So it goes back in time and covers some of the fights with Venom and Jean DeWolf and everything. And for some reason, I don't know, the goofy humor worked with me. But I can see if you don't find it funny, this book is not going to be for you. But so he bonds with each of his kids and, you know, he has a, there's a Days of Future Past where he goes back and possesses Kitty Pryde. That's the one that goes back in time. And just generally very ridiculous stuff. But basically, the real Frank Castle shows up, and then they end up going to the park, and that's when the Watcher comes in to intervene because, you know, as the comic rightly points out, for a guy with a non-intervention, he's always intervening. So they have a fun showdown in the last one where the Watcher pulls like a giant gun on Frank Castle. And then ends with, you know, the wrap-up of him basically saying it had to happen. There's no way. And ties it into the original sin with a Cosmic Ghost Rider helping to have the Watcher killed. And so, again, for the humor part, if the, like, for you, the humor wasn't working, so the whole thing lives and dies by it. But I liked it, and it was the same kind of a lot of deep cut references to existing storylines, but with a narrative framework. So I thought it was fun. I know everyone went crazy for this character, and I like when they do it as an oversized, basically, it, in fact, I think they make a joke about kind of stealing Deadpool, except not the fourth wall stuff, but just having an overpowered character in all these situations who's not taking it as seriously. And obviously, Cosmic Ghost Rider is ridiculously overpowered for almost every situation. Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do long-term with the character. Probably bury it and forget it. But
like everything else, fun. Cosmic.
Yeah, retcon it out or whatever. But if you like Paul Scheer, he's a pretty well-known stand-up, I think, or maybe sketch. He's in some different movies and everything like that. But that was the name that made me nervous. But like I said, for me, it ended up working out because I liked the humor in it. So that's my recommendation. So Steve and I are at log. It's funny. He recommends the one, and I'm recommending the other. But like I said, you can grab one issue of that Cosmic thing out of the 50-cent bin, and if you, it's seeming like you're laughing it up, then you should, then you're gonna like the other ones.
Kevin, is your mic on? No, I'm just kidding. What have you been reading,
of course,
man?
I don't know, I think I was gonna say some stuff you haven't been reading, but I think Andrew read this one maybe. Future Foundation?
I just read the first one, but I have the second one.
I've only read the first one. No Problem in the Multiverse Can't Be Solved by the Future Foundation. And then Dan Leaf Insect Man's like, so it's like Exiles, sort of? And I'm like, not really. Although that kind of does sound like the Exiles concept.
What would be cool is if somehow in the series, whether it be like the last issue or somewhere along the line, they show that they're working on such a thing, so you can imagine that it got developed. But it would be cool if somehow it was their work that led to the device that the Exiles used to use for their mission. Remember, they used Blink used to have that little gauntlet thing, you know, the little wristband that used
LS.
To, right, that used to bounce them around to the different things at the places and times of needs and stuff. And since it seems like the Future Foundation is almost, you know, you can see what Dan's talking about, that it is a similar type of a mission, or it seems like it's almost like the early days of putting together such a venture. That it could have maybe resulted in some kind of tech like that that they sent out into the multiverse.
You know, I hemmed and hawed about ordering this because I was like, Future Foundation, like, not one of those things I really wanted to get back into. But then I noticed that Jeremy Whitley from Unstoppable Wasp fame was writing it. So I was like, do I want to read some more good comics? And of course, at the end of the day, I was like, of course I do. So then, you know, I had to pick it up.
That's what led me to pick it up, too, was Jeremy Whitley. Originally, I think he was the Princeless guy and then came over to Marvel. And I was like, well, I like him a lot. But I got to say, Kevin, just movie what? Yondu. I don't like movie Yondu.
Oh. Yeah, sorry. Not my Yondu.
I just don't.
Obviously, but this whole cast of characters, no matter how good or bad or whatever, this modern day Yondu is supposed to be movie Yondu. I just don't care about that guy. It's like he does his thing, and I'm just like, whatever. And then we get on with the story, and I enjoy everything else. It's just one of those characters where I'm just like, I don't care about this guy.
Me neither. And what's with the solicit for the Yondu book where it's like the Yondu we know and love from the 30th century or whatever on the cover, but it's one of the interior pages that I saw. It was, you know, trash pirate Yondu. What's the deal with that? Are they going to try to resolve the whole Yondu thing finally or what?
I don't know. All I know is I won't be reading. So it won't mean, like, it won't really matter.
But I love the old Yondu and his whistling arrows so much. I want to find out why, you know, if they're going to put the original Yondu on the cover, that might make me check it out. Because maybe he's in there somewhere, Kevin. Maybe he's trapped inside that ridiculous gold tooth husk.
I like enough characters. And stuff like that. It's just like there's nothing really, I would say, wrong. Like there's certain things that there's a certain movie that's coming out. I'm like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with certain things. It's just it's not interesting for me. It's not my thing.
Yeah, for me that was the only knock against it. But it has that kind of witty team banter dialogue. You know, the characters are quickly and well established. They're little, you know, types of a type, but that's fine. Like, you have a big squad, so you need to, I'm sure as time goes on, we'll get more nuance in them. But I like that they quickly divide them. I also like that they at least have one non-genius on the team. I didn't want a team of all, like, super geniuses, so that part. And there's some mentions of that made it humorous, too. I like to. I don't know where I am on the Will Robeson, Danielle Orlandi, Greg Menzies art team. I don't know how I feel. I don't. It's not like other books I read, which is good. But I also feel at times it's a little. I don't know. Kevin, where are you at?
I think it's usually pretty nice. Like it's so clean and smooth. Like it looks like if you were gonna do this for like a younger audience where things aren't super confusing. Like there's none of that like crazy experimental style, but still it doesn't look boring. I should say, like there's enough there to keep me visually interested, but it's also nothing crazy.
I like that it almost looks 3D. It has that it has a certain flatness to it, but then the line, like the outlines, the thick dark outlines on each character really make them pop from the backgrounds, and it gives it's like more than a quasi anime type style. I don't like the eyes that are way too big. I've never been a fan of that stuff. And you know, it's the digital thing of like when the mouths are too big for the face, and you know, the side of an open mouth should never go all the way to the edge of the jawline, you know, that kind of thing. There's certain things that just look off to me sometimes, but overall, when I'm looking at the figures on each page, it just seems so colorful, yet the contrast of each form and shape is really pops. There's things to like about it, even though, you know, I get why you're not sure yet.
Yeah, I think you might be right on the expressions with the eyes and the mouths. Sometimes it feels a little over, like they're kind of overselling the facial expression.
Yeah.
But maybe Kevin's got it that it's for a slightly younger audience too, so they want to make it clear what each character's feeling at that moment.
The funny thing is, I would think that's the thing, but then you get into moments where, like, Julie Powers is talking about her entire history and, like, references to Runaways and all this stuff, and I'm like, that's a lot of stuff here. So maybe a little bit of trying to have it both ways.
That could be, but I also figure everyone's got Wikipedia now. Like, there's no... It's not like if you have a question, you can't Google or Bing yourself an answer to it. Oh, a lot easier than the old days.
Yeah, but it takes me out of a book.
Why would you Bing yourself, though?
If an info dump takes me out of a book, then, like, closing out my app and going into... You know what I mean? That takes me even more out of it. I'd rather the story tell me. But that's just
me. But I think kids are different, though. This is, Kevin's
episode, the Marvel Noise guys trying to figure out how kids read comics.
I think Kevin's point was that he was concerned that there's so much backstory referencing prior comics.
Yeah.
That a new reader wouldn't get it. But I feel like, especially, at least going back to my old man days when I read comics on stone tablets, that the not knowing created more of a hunger. Like, if you're into comics, when you first get into them, that not knowing things drives you just as much as the things you like, in a way.
Yeah.
It becomes this kind of discovering this whole new world that you devour. I mean, I think it's also reflected in the streaming content, how people like to binge shows and stuff. This, when you find this thing you like, there's a tendency, I think, for a lot of people to want to immerse themselves into it. So I think sometimes referencing those other things builds up the world and creates interests. And,
yeah,
you know, if you got Marvel Unlimited, you can look at a lot of old stuff or, like I said, search the character. So I think it's still...
Oh, I like a good footnote.
Younger.
I like a good footnote or two.
I was surprised because they referenced something once and then, like, it comes up again. And I was like, oh, I didn't think they would actually continue on, like, that track. There's a lot of fun stuff in here.
And I think
it is a prison break.
And it's also a lot of, let's face it, relatively newer stuff in the scheme of things. I mean, they could really get in the weeds with Dragon Man's history, but I think they're curious of if... I don't know that young readers, those sort of books... Like, I always feel there's a level for most people where our interest in that storytelling drops off. I think I've said, for me, Golden Age books don't really work. And I'm sure there's someone that loves every type of comic, but generally feeling most people have an era where that style just doesn't appeal to them. And maybe it's the modern style, or maybe I know another guy that doesn't really like comics before the 80s for the most part. The way they told the stories doesn't appeal to him. So I thought it was interesting that they're going in the weeds on, like, the Power Pack and, like you said, Runaway. Like, titles that seem friendly to younger people anyways.
Yeah.
Which seems natural. Like, oh, if you like a story about this young crew, well, you'd probably like Runaways and you'd probably like the old Power Pack and all that.
And there's things in here still that I don't know if it's original to this or if it's showing up in other places, like the planet they go to with the prison. Like, I have no idea. Like, I'm going to have to do research on, like, some of this stuff. And then one of the things, like, maybe if you're, like, you don't know all the Marvel stuff, like, there's something in here that I was just like, oh, no, don't tell them they're going to do something. So it's like, if you know, there's an extra sense of dread, and then you get to that last page, and I'm just like, no.
He seemed like an unnecessarily intense villain for the pace and tempo and stakes of the beginning story, but maybe they're not going to paint him as quite the bloodthirsty villain that he was. Because certainly this Yondu, even though he's movie Yondu, he's kind of a little bit jokier, you know? He's less... I would say he's a friendlier version of movie Yondu than the one in the movie. Oy. Like, I don't think he's out... you know, they put him in the same, you know, I'm out for myself, you know, getting the money, cynical-hearted bounty hunter type. But with a friendlier sheen, I would say. Like, maybe it's a smile or whatever, but I get the feeling this one has a little bit more of a heart, maybe, that externally shows.
I kind of wonder how nasty they're going to get. It's like the Punisher showing up in a Power Pack book or something. You're just kind of like, I wonder how this is going to go down.
But, yeah, it's been an interesting... I'll be curious where they end up taking it. And I could certainly see a crossover with the Wasp's crew. I mean, the whole science thing seems
to fit. Yeah, that would be interesting.
I like that, whether it's these special projects or these one-shots or in some of these books, like it sounds like is happening at Future Foundation, which I haven't read yet, but that they really are celebrating and exploring like the history of this fictional universe, which they should be. It's their anniversary, after all, right?
And it also is these new characters are getting new stories. Like, that's how you build... That's how we're going to have Bentley... Some sort of Bentley revival 20 years from now. The same way they revived, like, a minor character like Dragon Man. Like, if you don't build stories with the newer kind of characters... And, you know, the different Moloids and everything, they're giving them... all these cool stories so that, like I said, either they get bigger characters or they just stay in the background and years later a new writer resurrects them and brings them back in and people can have the same joy we get when we first saw them using these more obscure characters in different settings. And a huge shout out to the Power Pack Louise Simonson, June Brigman Gurihuru book that came out, that one shot. I don't know if you guys read that.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was wallowing in my old man sentimentality, so maybe it's dreadful, but to me it brought me back to the old days. I mean, it's just a simple... It's the young family when they're all kids still, and they go to a concert and mayhem ensues.
I like that they had both Brigman and Gurihuru, because Gurihuru did those fun series in the probably early 2000s where it's like Power Pack and Wolverine, Power Pack and Iron Man, Power Pack and Fantastic Four, and those were revisitation of those Power Pack characters who hadn't been around in quite some time.
And it felt like it was a reasonable place to kind of break the story and tell that other part of it. But yeah, I don't know if you don't have that sentimentality if the book works, though. I mean, we're revisiting those characters and memories and settings pretty quick, but if you had never read any, I'd be curious to someone who... what if they would have the same reaction.
I hear you. One of the other one-shots that I read was Marvel Monsters, which was written by Cullen Bunn with art by Scott Hepburn and a Nick Bradshaw cover with a bunch of floating monster heads and, of course, Fin Fang Foom right in the center spot, the center square, if you would. But, you know, it's their Kid Kaiju character, the youth who can sketch monsters and then they come to life. That kind of, you know, his name is Simon and the things he draws comes true, that whole bit. And he, in this story, he finds an old tome, an old book, Anatomy of the Monstrous, published by Timely Publications, of course. And the bulk of the comic is him reading the entries in the book, and you get descriptions of 10 monsters with a page that's a pinup page by a variety of artists. Like, the first one is a Stoko Fin Fang Foom, for instance. That's pretty good. And then on the facing page was like the entry in the book that had it almost was supposed to be like some cutaways of like their anatomy and some like labeling of some of their weapons and parts and things. Then, and I actually didn't like that so much because it seemed like more than we should know, and it wasn't even particularly that illuminating, the information. Like, I don't need to see a cutaway of Fin Fang Foom's clavicle, and then it's like, you know, Foom's clavicle with like a label on it. It's like, yeah. So it led to a, you know, once you saw what the visual of one of the entries looked like once, it just seemed like a repeated gag over and over again that kind of, they could have done a better job. Like when they did that hardcover book a few years ago, the A to Z of Marvel Monsters, they did, each page was similar to this. Each page was like a one of the old classic Marvel Monsters done by a modern artist. So you got like an Allred and, you know, all these different guys doing drawings of everything from Mangog to Celestials to everything else, because they were doing one for each letter of the alphabet. And on the facing page, you got all information about them that seemed a little brighter and funner than what you were getting out of this book. And in the back of that hardcover, they did a bunch of reprints of the old, you know, Tales to Suspense stories and Strange Tales stories that they first appeared in. So that's a real nice, and it's a thin hardcover, so it's under $20. And at the end of this, after he's done reading the 10 entries, he has a encounter with another character who seems like he's being introduced to be Kid Kaiju's nemesis or arch enemy, and that's Max Frankenstein. And he's after this book, too, because he wants it for whatever reason. And if you're a Frankenstein, you're probably bringing things to life. So he's probably animating dead tissue even as we speak. But, you know, hey, Stoko Fin Fang Foom. So it's not, it's definitely not, it gives you some of your money's worth.
I did not pick that one up.
Thought about it.
Did you get any of the other one-shots?
I had a bunch, but I never know. Was this a particular initiative or something? You know me and number one issues. I went and bought a whole bunch of them.
I think it was just celebrating the anniversary by having old characters or creators do some stuff.
Yeah, and even like the annuals have also been that, right? The annuals this year have been just taking a story of a character from somewhere in their past history and presenting it there. And they've done them from some weird characters, too. There was just a She-Hulk one, even though there's not a She-Hulk title right now. There was a Moon Knight annual, even though there's no Moon Knight title. So they're kind of using that as a vehicle, too. I think they're just trying to put a lot of stuff out there on the shelf, just like old days.
That's standard. Yeah, I think they're trying to, I mean, I did pick up, like I said, a bunch of those ones. So I am in that world. But, you know, like I said, Andy and number ones. It looks good, I'll buy it.
Did you get the Spider-Man
one? I'll buy this Nova number one twice.
Yeah.
I did the Eric Larson.
Right?
Was what sold me. And to be honest, of the three stories, it's the Eric Larson one that I would recommend out of the three. That was the one I thought that really was just fun and evocative and really brought it home.
Yeah, there's three stories in the book. There's a 17-page story by Jerry Conway and Mark Bagley. There's a 3-page story by Ralph Macchio and Todd Knock. And then there's a 10-page story written and drawn by Larson and colors by Laura Martin. And I swear, Andrew, like you said, it really brought it home that like the first page of that story is a big splash that brings me right back to the Bronze Age, like before Larson did Spider-Man back in the, you know, 90s. Like it brought me right back to the 80s. It was great.
Yeah, just so much energy and everything and fast pace. I mean, the first two were really heavy-handed, I felt. And I was like, is that the era we're going back to where Spider-Man teaches us an important lesson?
Yeah, but I did like the Conway story had the new, the evolution of that, the Spot character, the one that fought Daredevil not too long ago. He almost looks like a Clive Barker Hellraiser demon type of thing. But he has the Spot's powers, and this, you know, the Spot always had cool powers.
It is. It was cool. I felt there was a lot of lecturing in the book.
Yeah, there was.
And that just kind of, I don't know, I just felt like this isn't, I mean, you know, he's a famous guy and Conway can write what he wants, but it just felt like, wow. Talk about stop the story so you can tell us how you feel, which I don't know. I thought you could deliver the same message in a more subtle way that would make it more fun and save more pages for Eric Larson.
Yeah, right. Or just deliver it on Twitter and get it out of my comic.
And same with the Maki one. Although Todd Knock is always lots of fun, but it just was about bullies and standing up to bullies and all that. And yeah, that's a part of the comics and part of Spider-Man's history, but it also just feels like sometimes a bit simplistic and everything. But yeah, that Larson piece, come on. Nightshade's the bad guy. All kinds of altered humans fighting Spider-Man. Larson's composition is just so dramatic.
And I love how on the first page, that panel that I talked about, the splash page, has him saying, you know, he's coming towards the reader and, you know, he's giving you that the material is working on a few different levels because he's joking that, you know, he's back. Our prayers have been answered. You don't know if he's talking about Larson, you know, him being happy that Larson's drawing him again or if he's talking to Nightshade.
Yeah, just a fun, and I don't think there's anyone that, I don't know, it was that fun, oddly thin but still super muscular Spider-Man that Larson does.
Yep.
And I've just kind of missed it. Like, I had forgotten. Like, oh, that's right. I know it's kind of dumb, but I was like, oh, I forgot how much I like that Spider-Man. You know, you can like a bunch of different Spider-Men. It's okay. I still like Steve's Spider-Man. He's still my favorite.
I liked Larson more than his predecessor. I liked it better than the McFarlane stuff.
I was going to say, you better not be talking about Steve Ditko, Steve.
Oh.
I mean, I know it was referential to the McFarlane stuff, Larson's, but I liked that stuff better.
And I wanted to issue a correction as well. Steve, you and I talked about Spider-Man Life Story number one in the 60s, and this is where Andy, not reading any solicits or anything, gets in trouble, because we both read it, and I think we were both kind of perplexed at how it was going to work and what was happening.
Like, what the heck are we reading here? Captain America's left on the island, and wait, what?
But when I read them all, because the conceit is each one is a new decade, what it is just it's a what-if story, allowing for the conceit that Gwen isn't going to die and a few other things. But other than that, they work hard to still have things like Secret Wars come in and all that. I don't know. I just thought the team, Zdarsky, Bagley, Hennessy, Frank Darmada, all did Craven's Hunt. And so I thought it was fun, particularly because, as longtime Marvel fans know, originally Marvel was aging before they realized that was a very limiting gimmick to the characters.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made the 60s. And also I like the 60s because he leaves Ditko alone. He knows, like, the perfect Spider-Man you can't mess with at all. But you can screw with everyone else's Spider-Man just fine, and it works. And also I think he left it alone. I'm joking a bit because they were aging him up. So he goes through high school and graduates and goes to college. And that's when they start sort of messing with time a lot more And I was like, oh, what a neat experiment. And I like Zdarsky's writing, and Bagley's always fun. Same with Dell and Daramata. So I just, once I got the gimmick, I can now recommend it if that seems like something you're okay with. If you're like, I don't want to deal with some non 616 Spider-Man, I don't need to see a new event, you know, where the spider totems, that storyline. And
dude, I'd rather like just read that story. That's the problem. I didn't want to read a different, like, thank gosh Gwen died. Thank gosh all those things actually happened, because these were a lot more vanilla. Like, I'd rather read Kraven's Last Hunt than... It was great to see Bagley's art again on Spidey, and I felt that way about the going big thing, too, of him and the Conway story. Great to see Bagley on Spidey again. But that's kind of... That's what I came away with. I thought the other stuff was, you know... Just as you said.
What I liked about it, though, is it's an aging Spider-Man.
Yeah, I get it.
So it's him in that situation at different, as he's getting older, as opposed to the real world where he's always, what are we going to guess, like 28 for the most, some generically, you know, age where he's well out of college, or usually he's dropped out or whatever, and on his first or second professional job type of thing. So I enjoyed seeing that, and I think Zdarsky's I've come around to him, I guess, a bit on his writing. So yeah, I just enjoyed it, but I didn't understand after reading the first issue where they were going. It just took me reading a bunch, but I'm glad I stuck with it. But like I said, you can all wait for it to show up on Marvel Unlimited or whatever, because it's $5 an issue. Mm-hmm. So it ain't cheap.
Steve, giving the only bad review I've heard of this story so far.
Well, I'm glad you liked it, but I mean, I thought it was a lot more refreshing to read the revisitation of the Kraven's Last Hunt stuff over an Amazing Spider-Man by Spencer and Otley that they just did with the whole Arcade and Kraven thing. That, you know, made me fondly remember Kraven's Last Hunt a lot more than reading an alternate version of that story that takes its place in this universe or whatever. It's like, nah.
I can see that. I think I just relate to a aging Spider-Man as he's heading, you know, more of his life is behind him than in front of him. I can relate to that. I don't need a young Spider-Man where he's still got the whole world ahead of him.
And on the note of young Spider-Man, I keep on jumping in and out of the latest Miles Morales Spider-Man story. Because it seems like they always have something interesting going on. Like, there'll be a new villain or something. Like, the Ultimate Universe might be coming back. I don't really know. So I'm always popping my head, and I'm like, I wonder what's going on in that book again. You know, Gold Balls was there for a while.
So what's Miles
Maybe
up to
we'll
now?
Be again, who knows? So I picked up issue 10, or as some legacy fans will say, issue 250. So a story about Miles' birthday, and then he gets involved in some ultimate craziness where remember the ultimate Green Goblin?
Yeah, I disliked him vehemently.
I don't know. I see him here. Maybe I don't remember exactly what he looks like, or maybe they've toned down. I'm also not super familiar with Javier Garon.
It just seemed like when they did the whole Ultimate Universe, right? You're looking for the differences as a reader of the regular Marvel Universe, and some of them were just like the Green Goblin, why don't we make him an actual goblin, you know? Like, where'd you come up with that one, genius, you know? Some of it didn't seem like that thoughtful of nuances.
way more hits than misses, though. But I totally relate to the writer that does things like that, like, oh, people see Nightcrawler as a demon? Why don't they actually make him a demon? Like, usually if that's your train of thought, like, you better be selling that because sometimes it just doesn't work out. He looks but better guys, here, though, that Green Goblin.
But guys, Dr. Doom is a duck that fights Peter Porker.
Doctor.
Goose Rider? Genius.
Yep. I'll be the first to admit it.
So you have that story, and also there's a secondary character who I imagine will have pretty major ramifications on this book. But there's a second story too with the new character, secret origin of Starling. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this new hero / villain / vigilante, maybe. But they have ties to, like, another Marvel villain. So I was really interested to get more info on them and see how that goes down. So always a good title that I enjoy checking in on.
Miles Morales.
Indeed. I got the omnibus, too. Like, I was waiting for years. I'm like, I dropped off of the Ultimate Spider-Man, like in issues, then I bought the hardcovers, and then I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna buy the omnibus, and then of course the omnibus went out of stock before I was able to, and I'm like, really already? Like, some of those things is just, I don't know. I guess there's a lot of demand, so I was able to find at Fan Expo the omnibus. So nice. Finally, I'll be doing my massive Miles read.
I just got the second Straczynski Spider-Man omnibus.
Ooh. That's not the bad one, is it? it sort of ties into that Marvel 1000 too. Why is he in that book, JMS himself saying sins past. I regret sins past. Like that's sins past isn't in that omnibus, is it?
It might be. I mean, it was what we're talking about is during JMS, Mike Straczynski's Spider-Man run with Mike Diodato as the artist. He wanted to bring back the memory of Gwen by having two young adults show up, and they have powers, and it turns out that they are the love children of Peter and Gwen.
Why?
I don't know why. I guess they'll die.
I don't know. It's just questionable moments in his run, definitely.
So Marvel said no, kind of somewhere down the production chain, and they changed it to being Norman Osborn.
That doesn't make it any better.
No, it's worse. Because we had to see him. Yeah, anyway. Yep. But, of course, they burnt themselves out as these clones often do or whatever. Is the Gwen clone still alive? Didn't she? Or did she just walk off and have a great life? Or is she still out there?
I don't recall, but it seems like there's a lot of stories where she just walked off and disappeared, and then like 10 years later she shows up again.
Yeah,
like the one clone. Well, I shouldn't say the one clone. I guess like
there's as many as there needs to be.
She should meet Spider-Gwen.
Well, let's not. We can leave clone and Spider-Gwen for another time.
Like, Gwen also already met Gwen, so that was cool.
That was cool.
Well, at the D23 Expo, you can see the panel on Marvel.com, but I did go to the 80 Years of Marvel, where they gave out the exclusive cover of Marvel 1000 that I probably should have put on eBay that night, because it was fetching pretty funny. Wow. But now I have it. So it was fun. I would. It's much nicer to just watch the video because you're not sitting in a room with 1,000 other sweaty people jammed elbow to elbow. Because You know, they need to put bigger seats in those conference rooms, because some of us comic fans don't really fit one to a seat very well. But it was fun. So, yeah, I figure by now, because it's online and everything, there isn't much to talk about. It's on Marvel.com, and it's the 80th panel from D23. It's interesting. They go through the history. Watch it.
Yeah,
in the comfort of your own home.
That Marvel Comics 1000 thing was a pretty ambitious little book, wasn't it? I mean, there was a page for every year in Marvel history with some sort of little factoid of this happened in Marvel history that year. And for the most part, the one-page stories that accompany the little factoid relate to it, but not always.
Yeah.
And they had a variety of creators be involved, and a lot of them went with the 9-panel grid or variations thereof. And, you know, some of the things worked and some of them didn't. They tried to have, like, a little continuing narrative go through about the Black Mask, the Infinity Mask, they called it. And
those were the best stories.
Yeah, those were fun. Anytime I saw Al Ewing was writing it, I was like, okay, this could be good. And it's fun to see the different artwork and stuff. So, you know, it was fun. Some of the things just, I don't know, like reading Archie comics or reading old Strange Tales, monster stories or whatever. Like, once you get hit with that repeating format over and over again, there's only so much of it you can read in one chunk before you have to put it down. Otherwise, you realize you're just glossing through it.
There was that X-Men book that did the same gimmick that we covered not too long ago either. And like you say, it's a fun thing. My advice for people is wait. I'm going to think, because of all the covers and everything, I bet you'll be able to find copies of this at shows in the next few months for very cheap. Maybe in fact, at the last show I was at, the last show I went to, someone was already selling for $5 a piece. So, like, I think there's, don't worry about running out and getting, I mean, you're not going to get maybe the cover you want or whatever, but if you just want a copy, I think this is going to be like the .1 issues and everything where you just saw that, those it shows forever. But it's fun, like you said, to see all those Gabriel Hardman and Jeff Lemire and just people I wasn't expecting. Perez?
Yeah. But like an anthology, like, there's always going to be things like you don't really dig into. Like when I went into recap mode, I'm not as engaged in the material. Or you hit that block of text page and I'm just like, I'm like, okay.
But I mean, you know, that zero price point was good for me. Well, I guess it cost me a bunch of time. But,
oh, but it was, no, I got the She-Hulk cover.
It was funny that the JMS written page was all about different characters saying their greatest regret. And to kind of spiral back to how we segued into talking about this book, one of the panels is himself saying sins past.
But how bizarre is that?
Well, it obviously was ridiculous, and as we've said, and it was a hot mess, even from his side of it. So,
And I think only, like, I want to know how many people read this in one sitting, though, because I'm like, no, I couldn't do it. I'm like, that's just too much. Like, with a story per page thing, I'm like, there's just too much. I have to break that up. And I don't think, like, usually I was like, oh, that was cool. Or, like, it was usually something at least interesting.
No, so, my recommendation is after you read a page, rip it out of the book and then resort them however you want.
I'm gonna rip the J. Scott Campbell one out, though.
That was a funny page. I thought it was funny that it showed Mary Jane, like, slumping, sitting on the couch while she's looking at a picture of, like, one of the stylistic covers that Campbell has done in the past, saying, what, you think I sit on the couch like this? No, I sit like this. Blah, and she's eating Cheetos with dip.
but they're like, oh, this is the year that, I'm like, this is where, like, I don't, like, it was just a total fanboy moment for me. I'm like, yeah, I don't. So I'm like, so this wasn't a good year.
I thought it was fun of them connecting the golden age scientist guys trio into the Enclave from the Fantastic Four that created Adam Warlock, and that they go on to create Korvac. I that was fun. I thought that was really neat.
I also would have put in a blank page and said, "You write your own story."
Oh, you're ripping off someone else's book.
Ripping off a lot of stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, that would have been...
I mean, it fits in to have like 2020, and you write the rest of the story.
That would have been cool.
The rest
or have it be 2025 or something. And you're now a creator of Marvel. Write your own thing.
Nope, they're actually going to continue the story. We'll see what's going on with this Infinity Mask thing.
Yeah.
Do you think there was one page that was in honor of Jessica Jones's first appearance? And the page is very lightly dialogued, but it is credited, the writer is credited as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And even on the credits page later in the book, it also, like, it just has all the writers grouped and it has Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in there. And I'm guessing, do you think they got Bendis to come back just to dialogue that page and can't credit it? Or do you really think it was Lew Alcindor?
I thought I know he's a writer. And he did a comic book on Sherlock Holmes that just came out. So I assumed it was him.
Wow.
I mean, I haven't read the book, but I don't know. But yeah, I would assume it's him.
My name is Roger Murdoch. I'm the co-pilot. No, you're not. You're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. My dad says you don't try hard enough on defense. I love Airplane.
So 1001 next?
I guess so.